Okay, so this is bio 241, and it's January 29th. We're finishing up chapter 3 today, and are there any questions? Anybody have any questions finding your study materials online? Okay. Yeah.
I've read the book, and I know I've that sort of promised and wrapped around the show program.
Yeah. Nucleosome?
Yeah, that's probably it.
Yeah, that's it.
Then the only other question I had was a study guide that you put, figure 2.3.
Say it again?
You put a figure 2.3 in the study guide?
Yeah.
But I was just like sure what you wanted to know. Then can you blank parts on it?
Okay. Hey, let me see your notes. You got 2.3 on there? Because I can't remember what 2.3 looks like. Oh, that's chapter 3.
2.3 in the book.
2.3. Yeah, let me take a look at 2.3. So it's 2.3. Oh, it's a chemical?
Yeah, it's methane and ammonia. But
yeah, I wanted you to be able to show me some orbital theory there. How did those things go together? So first shell, second shell, you know, use your shell filling rules. So the first shell has 2 electrons. The second shell's got how many? 2, 4, 6, 8. Okay, and then you should just assemble those atoms together to make a methane, for instance. Because we did a water in class, and we did some other molecules in class. Just follow those same rules to actually build that molecule and fill those shells up. Yeah, you should be able to draw those things. And understand why you put them together that way.
Okay?
By knowing that orbital theory. And a good place to start with that is by knowing something about subatomic particles, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So, and that figure, yeah, I erased those atoms and their orbitals, so you should probably reproduce that, okay, that structure right there. Okay, so that's a pretty good question. All right, so last time we were talking about protein synthesis, and remember, protein synthesis is a two-step process. What's the first step? Where does it take place? It takes place in the nucleus, and what's it called?
Transcription.
Why do we call it transcription? Because it's really just the same language copy, right? We're making a copy of DNA, converting it to RNA, but RNA and DNA are the same language. It's like making a photocopy. So think of those two different molecules. What's the difference between an RNA nucleotide or a ribonucleotide versus a deoxyribonucleotide? Just that one oxygen atom, right? So they're very, very similar. Okay, so here this first step is transcription, second step translation. Translation happens in the cytoplasm. And don't forget, this is a one-way street, basically. And that is DNA directs the synthesis of proteins. Protein does not direct the synthesis of DNA. Because if it did, then that would change who you are. That would redefine your blueprint as you're living. Okay, so I think we talked about all this stuff last time. So here's chromatin. This is condensed chromatin. This is extended chromatin. Condensed chromatin is safe. It's protected. It's wrapped around into these nucleosomes. Right? When it's extended, right, it can be damaged, but then it is in a useful form. So in order for transcription to take place, it has to be extended before it can be transcribed. All right, so that's the trade-off. And don't forget, to go from an inactive form to an active form, the DNA has to be, or the chromosome has to be acetylated for that to happen. And then that gene is put back away in the luggage, so to speak. It becomes protected by deacetylating a part of that extended chromatin, and it winds itself back up tightly on a chromosome. Okay, so we covered all this stuff, right? Did we cover this last time? Yeah, okay, so we're into actually DNA. We talked about alternative splicing. So you would use alternative splicing to explain what phenomena? What phenomena? What is the old understanding of the correlation between the genome and the proteome? And that was? The old understanding was that there's a one-to-one correspondence. So for every protein in your body, you had to have a gene for it. But today, what do we know? What is the correspondence between the proteome and the genome?
1 to 100,000.
Okay. One what to 100 what? One. It can make, yeah, on average it makes 3. Okay, so one gene doesn't make just one protein, but it can make 3 on average. Some genes actually can make more than 3 proteins, so it's not a one-to-one correspondence. And we use alternative splicing to explain how one gene can end up making different proteins. All right, so don't forget, these introns are the parts that are thrown away, and the exons are used to make a messenger RNA. And different exons can be spliced together to form a different messenger RNA. Okay, we talked about that. Talked about universal genetic code. How would you know that this triplet right here is on DNA and not RNA? Can you see that pretty easily? Yeah, because there's a thymine in that triplet, not a uracil. What's another difference between the nucleotide? Another difference between DNA and RNA by its overall structure. Okay, deoxyribose versus ribose for RNA. What's another distinction between DNA and RNA? Yeah, the strandedness, right? DNA is double-stranded, RNA is single-stranded. Okay, so that's really what I wanted you to say. Okay, and then there are different kinds of RNA, messenger RNA, transfer RNA, and on the messenger RNA, there is a triplet code. What do we call the triplet code on a messenger RNA? That's a codon, right? That's going to code for an amino acid being inserted into a protein, and the universal genetic code just tells us how to translate from a nucleotide sequence to an amino acid. So, for instance, CUU is going to code for leucine at that particular location of a protein. That's what the universal genetic code is all about. And the reason why do we need a triplet code to define an amino acid and not just a single base? Why can't it just go cytosine calling for leucine right here? Because there's 20, yeah, there's 20 amino acids, right? Pretty much naturally occurring amino acids. And so you need at least 20 different kinds of combinations of nucleotides to code for all those different amino acids. Okay, and there's some redundancy. All right, we talked about this. Make sure you know that going from DNA to this messenger RNA is called transcription, and then using a ribosome and a transfer RNA, taking information, the primary sequence of nucleotides and a messenger RNA, how that's converted into a primary sequence of amino acids in a protein. And that step we call translation, and that happens in the cytoplasm using a ribosome and transfer RNA. All right, and it's this part of the transfer RNA that binds to the messenger RNA, so this has to be complementary in nature to the codon on the messenger RNA. All right, so did we look at these slides last time? I guess we did, huh? Oh, we didn't. I thought you said we were at DNA replication already. We stopped right here? Protein synthesis. Oh, okay. All right, good. Okay, so here is, all right, messenger RNA. It's a big, long molecule. And this is the blueprint on how to make a protein. So, for instance, on the previous slide, we saw a triplet code, which is the start signal for translation. What's the start signal? What's the codon for starting protein synthesis or translation? Okay, the start signal, yeah, is AUG. All right, so if we look at this one right here, what do we see? AUG at the beginning of this messenger RNA molecule. All right, so that's one codon, and then a ribosome is going to move all the way down and see the next codon. The next codon is GGC, and then you have to use the universal genetic code to find out. Do we have it on? Oh, we do have it on here. All right, GGC. What amino acid is going to be placed next to? Actually, methionine is the first amino acid that's put on a protein as it's being made, along with the start signal. All right, then glycine is going to be bound to methionine. How do we bind glycine to methionine? What kind of reaction is used? It forms a peptide bond, but what's the name of that reaction that forms that peptide bond? That's a dehydration synthesis reaction, right? Just the one that you've learned about already. So now we have a methionine bound to a glycine via peptide bond formed by dehydration synthesis reaction. All right, and then the ribosome moves down to the next triplet code, which is UCC. That's the third codon. All right, and the transfer RNA brings in the next amino acid. And do we have UCC on our UCC right here, serine? Okay. So this is not the complete genetic code. This is just partial for some of these amino acids that we're working with. Okay. And then serine gets bound to glycine via dehydration synthesis, producing a peptide bond between these. All right. So you might be asking, well, how does the ribosome know to put serine right here? It's got an instruction, but how does serine get inserted right into this position? And that's because when there's a messenger RNA on a ribosome, it reveals these, what we call codons. This is a codon. What kind of RNA triplet can bind to UCC? It's going, what are the base pairing rules for RNA? It's going to be U and A, C and G, and C and G. So there has to be what we call an anticodon on a transfer RNA that has the correct triplet code that will bind, okay, according to the base pair rules on the messenger RNA. So only that one specific transfer RNA bringing in this serine molecule can bind and form that peptide bond. All right, let's look at isoleucine right here. What's the triplet? What's the codon on messenger RNA for isoleucine? It's going to be AUC. And what's the only kind of transfer RNA that can bind to AUC right here? It's going to be, okay, don't forget, in RNA, there are no thymines, so what's going to bind here is uracil, so it's going to be UAG. So there's going to be a transfer RNA with a UAG right here, and bound to it is isoleucine, so isoleucine gets added in that particular location. So I think I belabored this point a little bit because I want you to know that the codons are in messenger RNA and the anticodons are where? On the tRNA or the taxi RNA or transfer RNA. So don't forget, the job of the transfer RNA is to wander around all over the cytoplasm, find its particular amino acid, and then carry it back to the ribosome so that translation can take place. That's the job of the tRNA. So here's a pretty good picture that shows that. Here's the first triplet code. All right, so this triplet right here, is this a codon or an anticodon? That's the codon. What about this next triplet right here? That's a codon. So we always have codons on the messenger RNA, and only the proper base pair, okay, anticodon can bind to this codon. So here is the fourth codon. And here's a transfer RNA that matches up properly, and it's going to bring, in this particular case, the fourth amino acid in. And here is the fifth codon. This transfer RNA has the proper anticodon to bind to the messenger RNA that brings in the fifth amino acid. And inside the ribosome, that dehydration synthesis reaction takes place. And then this growing polypeptide chain gets bound and forms a peptide bond with the next amino acid right here. All right, and then what does this ribosome do after this peptide bond is formed? It slides up and reads the next codon on messenger RNA, and that allows the next transfer RNA to come in so that another peptide bond can be formed. Okay, and then when it reaches the end of the messenger RNA, the process stops because there's a stop signal. In your notes, do you see what the stop signal is? What's the stop signal? What's the codon for stop? UAG. Yeah, and when it sees UAG, the ribosome hops off of the messenger RNA, and the protein then is free to go wherever it should be going. And that could be in the cytosol, or if this ribosome is attached to endoplasmic reticulum, that protein then is inside the endoplasmic reticulum, which would be what? A rough kind of endoplasmic reticulum. So here we see a protein that's being made. It's getting longer and longer and longer and longer. And it ends up in the, because this is rough endoplasmic reticulum, it ends up in the cisterna of endoplasmic reticulum. Now what happens to this protein right here? What's the possible fate of this protein since it's inside the endoplasmic reticulum? Okay, it's going to go to the Golgi apparatus for modification and packaging. So what are the two possible places where it could get packaged? Into a secretory vesicle, for instance, for secretion outside the cell, or maybe it's going to be placed in a vesicle that stays inside the cell. Could you give me the example of a vesicle inside the cell that has proteins in it that have a function? Lysosome. What kind of protein does a lysosome have? Lysozyme, which does what? It's digestion. Yeah, it breaks complex molecules down into their building blocks. And another kind of vesicle would be the peroxisome, and the function of a peroxisome is for detoxification of harmful compounds. Right. Okay. Sorry about that. Oh yeah, so here's the functions of the Golgi for modification or packaging. And for instance, this glycoprotein, let's talk about this glycoprotein. Anytime you see this glyco, that means a sugar of some kind, maybe glucose for instance. And of course protein, you know, the building block of protein. So now we're combining two different kinds of biomolecules together. And a typical example of a glycoprotein would be mucus. Alright, so mucus has a number of different functions in your body. It's that stuff that runs out of your nose when you have a cold. And sometimes, along with mucus, there's lysozyme, okay, coming out of your nose, which does what? It helps kill bacteria, right, that are infecting you. But it probably also digests your nose a little bit as well. You probably get a really raw nose if you have a runny nose for a long time. Okay. All right, so that Golgi body packages that mucus, for instance. So mucus is a glycoprotein. Since it's a protein, it also acts like a buffer and maintains pH, and it's also a lubricant. All right, and that glycoprotein, mucus, should not be inside the cell. It should be exported outside the cell, secreted outside the cell via what kind of process? Exocytosis, right. And what can you tell me about exocytosis? What can you remember about exocytosis? It's a way of a cell secreting something. Okay, but what is there a requirement? Did we talk about any requirements for exocytosis? It's active transport. It requires energy, and that energy is in the form of what's the energy molecule in our bodies? ATP, requires ATP for that to happen. Okay. All right, DNA replication. Okay. Well, let's talk about cellular replication or cellular reproduction. You're pretty familiar with all this stuff already, I'm sure, from anatomy. But here's a typical kind of human cell. And I'm not sure if you would know this because it's biology, unless somebody's taken a biology class. But how many chromosomes does a human body have? It's got 46, right? And in particular, right, it's not just 46 different kinds of chromosomes. They're arranged. What's a special arrangement in chromosomes? You have one set over here and another set over here. And you all, I'm sure, are very familiar with this. There's a 1, 2, 3, all the way down to number 23. And guess what's over here? There's another number one, another number three, all the way down to 23. All right, so 23 and 23 is 46. Right, and you get this set of chromosomes from one person, and you get this set of chromosomes from another person. Who are those people? Okay, this set you get from your mom, and this set you get from your dad. So we call these the maternal chromosomes, and these are the paternal chromosomes, right? So So, yeah, I was going to say papa, but that's not right. Paternal. All right, so here is a process called mitosis. What the heck does mitosis do? It allows for the replication of this cell. Right here and right here. And what are the purposes? What's the function of mitosis? You're going to say, well, reproduction to make two cells. Yeah? Okay, so if you just say reproduction, you're just saying, well, mitosis, that's the same thing. But so we really want to know what the function is, and I liked your answer a lot. One of the reasons is for growth. All right, at one point in time, way back when, you were just a single cell. All right, when a sperm fertilized an egg, you were just a single cell. And in order for you to come to a physiology class and take notes and all that kind of stuff, you need to be more than one cell to do that. So how do you get from one cell to trillions of cells? You have to grow through this process of mitosis, so to add cells to your body. That's one important thing. So growth is number one. And there's another reason, too. Another reason for mitosis. Another reason for mitosis is all the cells that you have today are not the cells that you had even 5 minutes ago, and certainly not a week ago or a month ago or something like that. So cells in your body wear out and they die, and when they wear out and die, in order to stay healthy, what does your body have to do? Replace them, right? So replace old or damaged cells. Replace old or damaged. That's the function of mitosis. So for instance, another good example of that is a red blood cell. That's a very important cell that carries oxygen everywhere in your body. It only lives for about 120 days, and then it dies. It doesn't have a nucleus. It just has a very finite lifespan, which is really short. Right? So does anybody have a feel for how many red blood cells die in your body every second? Every second. You have lots of red blood cells in your body. But how many die every second? Millions, that's right. Between 2 and 3 million red blood cells die every second in your body. And what's that pathology? What's the name of the pathology when you're deficient in red blood cells? Abnormally low number of red blood cells in your blood. What's that called? That's just anemia, yeah. So how does your body prevent you from becoming anemic? What does it have to do? It has to make 2 to 3 million red blood cells every second. Okay? So that's what? You're busy. Even when you're sleeping or taking notes, you're really busy building red blood cells. But that's just one example. You're busy building many other kinds of cells. And you build cells by what kind of process? Mitosis, right? So these cells right here are called daughter cells. And this cell right here is called a parent cell. And does anybody know what the difference is between these daughter cells right here? Okay, that's got trick question, because they're identical to each other. They're the same. All right, so these guys are the same. They're identical. You could think of these as being clones of each other, right, in kind of a science fiction kind of way. Now, what's the difference between these two daughter cells and the parent cell with this process right here, mitosis, only considering this process? And again, you're going to say, oh, there's no difference. Right? So the daughter cells are identical to each other, and they're identical to the parent cell right here. So here is kind of the question that took me a long time to formulate. Here's a chromosome. That's what a chromosome looks like. Just kind of a bow tie, a very simple illustration. So if we had 46 chromosomes over here, how many chromosomes are we going to have over here in this daughter cell? 46. What about this daughter cell? You sure? 46? How can you have 46 over here? See, this is 46. How can you have 46 over here and then end up with 46 over here if we're splitting the cell in half? What do you got to do first? Yes, they reproduce, and we call that process replication. Okay? So that's DNA replication. And when a chromosome is replicated, it doesn't look like that. It kind of looks like that. It looks like an X. All right, and then when it's replicated, then the cell can go through mitosis, and then both cells end up with the same number of chromosomes. So DNA replication is very important as a step before mitosis. All right, so that's what I have on this. You saw the answer all along. Okay, so when cells divide, DNA replicates itself prior to mitosis, right, and identical copies go to the two daughter cells, just for that reason right there. All right, so just like RNA, what's the name of the enzyme that makes RNA? Because RNA, what is RNA? What kind of, is it a simple molecule, or is it a big long chain of building blocks, or what? It's a big long chain filled with building blocks, so you could consider RNA a polymer, right? Well, RNA is a polymer, and so is DNA, right? Because it has the same building blocks, almost the same building blocks. All right, so first, you didn't answer the question. What's the name of the enzyme that makes RNA? RNA polymerase. So guess what the name of the enzyme is that makes DNA? It's called DNA polymerase. How does DNA polymerase, or what's the name of the chemical reaction that DNA polymerase uses to make DNA? Okay. Just dehydration synthesis reaction by pulling out a water molecule between the two nucleotides. The same thing over and over and over again. Okay, so first there's a helicase that breaks the hydrogen bonds to produce two free strands of DNA, because DNA is normally, what's the strandedness of DNA? It's double-stranded. In order for it to be replicated, those two strands have to come apart. And a helicase is something that does that. And as a matter of fact, you could even just call it a unwinder case if you wanted to. It's an unwinder enzyme. We just kind of make up names. Helicase probably sounded cooler than unwinderase. Right, and that also unwinds the DNA molecule, separates the two strands. Now, is that difficult to you to do? How would you think of that? Is it difficult to separate those two strands of DNA?
Yeah.
Okay. No, I would say no, because why? How do you know that those two strands are stuck together? What's putting those two strands together? It's the size and the shape, they match properly, but it's also just very weak hydrogen bonds. Right? So those hydrogen bonds can form or could be broken very easily. It doesn't require a lot of energy to do that. All right, so then the DNA polymerase binds to each strand and starts to make a new complementary strand using the old strand as a template. We'll see how that goes. And then, of course, it has to follow the DNA base pairing rules, which are GCAT. And then you get two new chromosomes composed of one new strand and one old strand. When that happens, we call that semi-conservative replication. So you should have a feel for what that term means, semi-conservative replication. All right, so I think our next slide right here shows the process very nicely. So here we have an old DNA molecule that we want to replicate. Now, do we want to change the sequence of nucleotides in this DNA molecule? Okay, think about that for a second. Is it okay if we change the sequence of nucleotides in a DNA molecule? What happens if that happens? Okay, it would be corrupted, all right, because, and what would that mean for the individual? If we change the sequence of nucleotides in DNA, which is the primary sequence, right, if we change the primary sequence of DNA, what is that going to change the primary sequence of? Okay, that's going to change the primary sequence of the messenger RNA. And if that changes the primary sequence of messenger RNA, that's going to change the primary sequence of the protein, right? Which is what? The sequence of amino acids in the protein. And if the primary structure of a protein changes, what changes? The secondary structure, right? And then the tertiary structure, and maybe even the quaternary structure of those proteins. And when the structure of a protein changes, what happens to the function of that protein? It changes as well, right? So if there's a change during any process right here, for instance, during DNA replication, if the primary sequence of DNA is changed, that's going to change the function of proteins that are going to be made by that gene. And most times, it's not a beneficial change, right? It's a deleterious change. It might cause the death of that cell. So when DNA replication takes place, it has to be replicated with high fidelity so that you get two of the exact same molecules again in terms of the primary sequence of nucleotides in DNA so that the proteins don't suffer. Okay, so how is that accomplished? Well, the DNA molecule strands, the handrails of a DNA strand are never broken. What molecules make up this rail right here? Can you remember? That's sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate. Those bonds are never broken because when they're broken, then you lose the primary sequence of DNA and that will probably kill the cell. All right, so the only thing that happens is that it unzips and it unwinds, right? And then the DNA polymerase attaches to the old strand and then it starts to add nucleotides. All right, so here is the old strand right here. So here's a G on the old strand. DNA polymerase will only allow what to bind right here? Cytosine, right? Just because of the shape and the number of hydrogen bonds. And then it's going to move up to the next base right here, and we see a C, so DNA polymerase will add a G. All right, and then the next one, A, and then the DNA polymerase will add a T. And then finally, the whole DNA strand is going to be replicated. And the same thing for the other strand of the old DNA molecule. So here we see one old strand and one new strand. On the other side, we see one old strand and one completely new strand. So when DNA replicates itself, the old strands are never broken, never rearranged. They're used as an exact template of how the new strand should be made by complementary base pair ruling. So there's high fidelity in copying this molecule, right? It doesn't get corrupted. So you see what semi-conservative replication means? That a new strand of DNA that's made during a replication process has one old strand and one completely new strand. That's what we mean by semi-conservative. If it was fully conservative, it would mean that the two new chromosomes are made so that one chromosome is completely of the old strands of DNA and the other chromosome would be of the new strands that are made. But it's not made that way. And it can't be made that way because the old strands are used as a template. Right? So that makes this process very reliable. So if you were going to make some clothing, for instance, maybe you wanted 20 copies of your favorite shirt. How would you do that so that you could get 20 exact copies of your favorite shirt? What would you use? You would use a template, right? And just copy that information to some fabric and just make that same shirt over and over again. Okay. So that's DNA replication. That has to happen before mitosis takes place. Okay, so most cells... Let's talk about mitosis in just a little bit more detail. I might go through this kind of fast because this is really old review for most of you folks from anatomy. Most of the cell's life, it's an interphase, and it's doing its job during that period of time. It's not replicating. So, for instance, what's the job of a goblet cell during interphase when it's not dividing? What's the job of a goblet cell? It's making mucus and then it's secreting it onto that apical surface on an epithelium someplace, right? So that's what's happening during interphase. And in order for that goblet cell to be making that mucus, what form is the DNA in? What form is the DNA in? The DNA could be in two different forms. What are the two forms? It could be... We would call it chromatin of some kind. It could be extended chromatin or condensed chromatin, but when it's busy using that DNA, is it extended or condensed? It's extended, right. So in interphase, the chromatin is extended. It's being used for protein synthesis, right? And when it's extended, it should be behind that nuclear envelope that protects it from everything else that's going on inside the cell. All right, so here is pretty much the whole cell cycle. During G1, some organelles replicate themselves. So we usually don't use that word duplicate in biology. We use that word replicate. All right, the S phase of interphase DNA replication takes place. And G2 is a phase where there's final growth of some organelles before the cell undergoes mitosis. And I believe in G1 right here, this is the phase where the cell does its normal activity, whatever that cell is supposed to do. Right, for instance, this is the phase that a goblet cell is going to be in when it is synthesizing and secreting mucus. All right, but when it's time to grow or replace old and damaged cells, this cell will go into the active form of mitosis. And you know these phases, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase, right? And so don't forget about interphase. So I have people usually remember what's the acronym that tells you the order of the phases of mitosis. It's IPMAT, right, for interphase, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. So that shows you the phases of mitosis. All right, let me see, do we have these right here someplace? Okay, right here. All right, so what does interphase look like? We see a nice nuclear envelope right here. We see a nucleolus. Don't forget, the nucleolus is the active part of the nucleus. This is where transcription is taking place at a very high level. We see some centrosomes. You might only see one centrosome. And if we look at a micrograph, we see what? We see a nice nuclear envelope. And if we look inside the nucleus, we see some dark areas showing activity. But if we look really closely, I don't see any chromosomes. I don't see anything that looks like what? Like this thing right here. It's pretty homogeneous except for the nucleoli, the active part of the nucleus right there. So that's a dead giveaway of interphase. All right, the cell gets a signal to divide. Extended chromatin gets turned into condensed chromatin. So now you should actually see chromosomes in that area where the nucleus was. The nuclear envelope disappears. Right? If the nuclear envelope disappears, that means that this DNA is in jeopardy of being corrupted, but is that a major concern right now? Why is that not a major concern? Because what kind of chromatin is this right here? This is condensed chromatin, so the DNA is protected. Also what happens, I can't see it on this slide necessarily, but the centrosomes start to migrate to either poles of the cell, microtubules, then start to arrange themselves between the centrosomes, forming a spindle apparatus. All right, so these are all things that happen during prophase. So you should be aware of all of these things that happen during prophase. And this might be, for instance, all these things happen during prophase. So what else happens during prophase? You had a nice diagram right here. So this chromosome right here, has it been replicated or is this a non-replicated chromosome yet? It's replicated, right? There are actually two chromosomes. They're attached to each other. Where are they attached to each other? By the centromere. And the centromere can attach itself to the spindle apparatus. For instance, right here, there's some other proteins that get associated with the centromere called the kinetochore, and they attach themselves to these microtubules. And what can you tell me about the function of microtubules inside the cell? What do they do for... In general, what they do for stuff inside the cell? For shape, okay? They can shape the structure of the cell. They can make a cell squamous or cuboidal, okay? But it has another function. Yeah, for moving things around. Think of all those microtubules or microfilaments as being a monorail system, and once it attaches to the chromosome, it can start to move these chromosomes around inside the cell, okay? So... that's what you see right here. It moves all the chromosomes to the equator of the cell. And this phase we call metaphase. That's the easiest phase to see, right? Even on this micrograph, we see the two centrosomes, this nice spindle apparatus. Right in this location here, chromosomes are lined up. Okay, so that's metaphase. The next phase, anaphase, that's when the chromosomes separate from each other. So let me go back to this slide right here. So here is a replicated chromosome. So here is one chromosome. I don't know, maybe they cross over. Let's just say here's one, and then here's the other one right here. Sometimes we call these two parts of these two chromosomes that are joined together right here at the centromere, we call these sister chromatids. Or some people just call them chromatids. So here's one chromatid, here's the other chromatid or other sister chromatid. These are what? Two really separate chromosomes. They're identical to each other. They're just attached at the centromere. So during anaphase, the sister chromatids separate from each other. Right here. And I know this is anaphase and not prophase, because if it was prophase, there would be a random arrangement of these chromosomes in this space over here. Let's go back. See, there's a random arrangement right here. Right? Notice it's highly ordered. They're lined up. So this has got to be anaphase. And then the spindle apparatus retracts the sister chromatids to the opposite ends of the cell. And then this is telophase. During telophase, how can you tell telophase apart from anaphase right here? Okay, it's kind of maybe hard to tell unless you start to recognize some things. Right, because I see two lines. You see, right, a cleavage furrow. So the cells are starting to separate. See this big dimple right here? And there's another dimple right here. The parent cell is starting to separate into two daughter cells. And also the chromosomes are very close to the centrosome complex right here. So that's kind of a dead giveaway that this is telophase. The process of making this cleavage furrow and separating the cytoplasm into two separate cells, right, is the phase is called telophase, but the process that happens within telophase, right, you have to know what that's called. That's called cytokinesis, right? So the separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells is cytokinesis. And another question I could ask is, when does cytokinesis take place? What phase of mitosis? You would say telophase, right? All right, and if you take a sophisticated biology class, you might read textbooks and have all kinds of discussions about when telophase really does take place. But in this class, right, you're going to say that cytokinesis takes place during telophase, not after telophase. It doesn't begin in anaphase and go into some other phases for this class, all right? But under certain circumstances and certain cells and different kinds of organisms, right, that might not be true. And people will be talking about, well, when does cytokinesis really take place? Maybe for the next 100 years. But in this class, we can settle that right now. We'll say what? Cytokinesis happens during telophase, right? Okay. All right, so that's mitosis. Yeah. Oh, there's something else that happens during telophase too, but I'll get to that in a second.
Where's the
parent cell? It's gone. The parent cell, I'll circle what was the parent cell. See this right here? This was the parent cell. This whole thing was the parent cell. And it's now splitting into two daughter cells. Is that your question? You see that there now or no? Not really, huh?
Why can't that leave the main thing?
No, it doesn't stay. The parent cell disappears. The parent cell sacrifices itself to make two daughter cells. But they're identical. So in a sense, the parent cell is still there. Nothing has been lost. As long as DNA replication didn't produce any errors, that cell is still there. That information is still there. Okay. So the parent cell actually splits into two daughter cells. The process of splitting the DNA up into two daughter cells is what we call mitosis. The process of splitting the cytoplasm up into two separate daughter cells is what we call cytokinesis. Okay, so that you could think of it that way. Okay. So cytokinesis is definitely a process that happens within mitosis. Okay. So the organelle that organizes the microtubules within the cell for moving organelles and chromosomes around during mitosis. It organizes microtubules to give the cell its shape, right, is the centrosome, or the centriole complex right here. And these centrioles, here's one and here's one, they don't have a membrane around them, so we don't call that a membrane-bound organelle. Membrane-bound organelles have a membrane around it, that's all that means. So could anybody give me an example of a membrane-bound organelle? Golgi apparatus is made with a membrane system. Endoplasmic reticulum has a membrane around it. Nucleus, organelle with a membrane around it. Centriole, no membrane around it. There's another organelle that doesn't have a membrane around it that we talked about today. What's the name of another organelle that doesn't have a membrane around it? I don't know. Ribosome, yes, perfect. Yeah, good answer. Ribosome doesn't have a membrane. It's not membrane bound. Okay, so you can probably see that most organelles have a membrane around them. And I think we talked about why does a cell have all these different organelles in there with membranes around them, mostly? Did we talk about that? Okay, why does a cell have all these different kinds of organelles inside of it? Yeah, to keep it alive, absolutely. But I don't know, let's get a little bit more specific. Yeah, the more complex the structure, that lends itself to a more complex function, indeed. Yeah, because a cell has a lot of different functions, and those organelles all have different functions, right? Like mitochondria is responsible for ATP synthesis, RuffER is important for protein synthesis, SmoothER is important for lipid synthesis, all right. But so, did I give you my analogy of a cell compared to this building? Did I? I think maybe I did. Okay, because a cell is like this building. If this building were just one big room, right, and all the students, all the physics students came in, and math students, and biology, and anatomy, and engineering, and chemistry, all came into one room, there would just be mass confusion. We would interfere with all these other classes. So organelles are inside the cell to perform all those separate and distinct functions without interfering with other important distinct functions within the cell. Okay. All right, so one last thing about mitosis, and that is a telomere. Okay, telomeres are the ends of the chromosomes on each sister chromatid. And each time the cell divides, a length of that telomere is lost, right? Because the DNA polymerase can't copy the very end of a DNA segment, so a chromosome actually gets shorter and shorter and shorter every time it's replicated, right? And then when that telomere is used up, the cell becomes what we call senescent. It's too old, right? And then it dies, right? So we believe that to represent a molecular clock for aging. So a cell can't reproduce itself by mitosis indefinitely because the chromosomes get shorter and shorter and shorter. Okay. And all right, meiosis, a little bit different kind of process compared to mitosis. All right, but it is a process of cell division. Right, and I want you to know a little bit about meiosis. So mitosis makes two identical daughter cells, and the DNA is conserved, it's fully conserved. The DNA in the daughter cells is exactly equal to the parent cells. But meiosis is a different kind of cell division. Instead of getting two cells, right, we get four cells out of it. Oh, I tell you what, let's go back to this cell right here, the parent cell. So how many chromosomes are in this parent cell again? 46. But a better, more sophisticated understanding is that those 46 chromosomes can be grouped into what? maternal and paternal sets, right? And because you have two sets of chromosomes, sometimes we call the genetic material in this cell, this is a 2N cell, meaning that it has two copies of all chromosomes. Or we could say that it is diploid. It is diploid. If it has 46 chromosomes or two copies. So I could ask you, what's the ploidy of most cells in your body? What's the ploidy? That means how many copies? It has two copies of every chromosome. So the ploidy of this cell right here is diploid, or you could say 2N. 2N or diploid is exactly the same terminology. That's the ploidy of this cell right here. All right, what meiosis does, so I got to change the term right here. What does meiosis do? All right, meiosis is actually going to make four cells. And in these cells, we don't have 46 chromosomes. We only have 23 chromosomes. So we have a number 1, we have a number 2, all the way down to a number 23. And the same for this cell, and this cell right here. Okay? And these chromosomes right here don't come from exactly one set. Number 1 could come from this maternal set, number 2 could come from the paternal, number 3 the paternal, and then number 4 the maternal again. It's just always a flip of the coin which one of these chromosomes, either the maternal or paternal, end up in this cell right here. So there's always a random mixing of chromosomes. So what's the ploidy of this cell right here? What's the ploidy of that cell?
Haploid.
That's what we call haploid, or 1N. We could say, I'll write it up here, 1N, or because it has half the number of chromosomes, that's haploid. And these cells are real important, right, because these are sex cells. And there's another name for a sex cell. Another name for a sex cell is a gamete. All right, that's a general name. And so males make these kinds of gametes. Right? Give me a specific name of a gamete. A specific name would be a sperm, right, or an egg. So females make eggs, male makes sperm. All right, so meiosis produces gametes by reducing the number of chromosomes. It's a nuclear division. It's a nuclear reduction, actually. What, it cuts the nuclear material in half? Okay, so that is meiosis. Now let's just say that we have a female over here, and we have some eggs. So here we have a sperm and an egg, and they're going to join to form this cell. What's the ploidy of this egg right here? It's going to be produced by, I'll give you a hint, it's going to be produced by meiosis as well. What's the ploidy of this egg right here? It's haploid, right? So it's 1N. This is 1N. Just one set of chromosomes. It's got a 1, a 2, a 3, a 4. It shouldn't have any duplicates of chromosomes or omissions of chromosomes. If it does, well, then it's going to produce, you know, birth defects. In most cases, pretty horrible. Or death of this cell right here. All right, so here is a cell. What's the ploidy of this cell right here? When a sperm gamete and an egg gamete join, what's the ploidy of this cell? Well, you got one set of chromosomes from the dad, one set of chromosomes from the mom. Now you're back to 2N, right? That's just like a normal human cell right there. That's diploid. And two more questions. What do we call this process of forming? No, I tell you what. Don't answer that one. Let me start with this first. What's the name of this cell? I told you earlier today. What's the, this has got, these are called gametes. What the heck is this thing called? That's the zygote. Right, so here's a zygote. That's where we all were at one point in time. Now, what's the process that's used to take two gametes, or the process that two gametes use to form a gamete? Yeah, I probably shouldn't tell anybody. Just put it on the test. That's what you call fertilization, right? That's fertilization, right? All right, and then what's the process that's used to make that? What's the ploidy of that? What's the ploidy of this, of all of the cells, or at least most of the cells in this organism? All right, that's 2N, diploid. Most of the cells in your body are diploid. How do you go from a single cell that's diploid to trillions of cells that are diploid? What's the name of that process? That is mitosis, right? All right. There's some other processes that happen, but in a nutshell, okay, that's what happens there. So meiosis produces gametes that are haploid. Fertilization brings the genes back to 2N, that's a zygote, and you go from a single cell to trillions of cells via mitosis, right? Okay. All right, so what about meiosis? Well, just like in mitosis, the DNA has to be replicated. It's first replicated, so you have replicated chromosomes inside of a cell. So for meiosis, we call this a germ cell. A germ cell is going to make gametes. Okay? A lot of people use the terminology stem cell, but that's really not correct. A stem cell is a cell that can produce different kinds of tissues in your body, like maybe nervous tissue or muscle tissue or something like that. It's not differentiated. And that's sort of like a germ cell. A germ cell can make any kind of tissue in your body, but in particular, a germ cell is going to make a gamete or a sex cell. Okay, so these chromosomes in a germ cell have to be replicated first. All right, so what does it look like, meiosis? And instead of one round of separation, there are two rounds of separation. Let's take a look. I think this slide is probably pretty good. So here is, it almost looks like I need to focus, but I think it is in focus. All right, so here we see the nucleus. And is this chromatin in an extended form or condensed form? It's condensed because you see chromosomes in there, right? And I only see, for instance, maybe a number 1 and a number 2. Here is a number 1 chromosome from mom. Here's a number 1 chromosome from dad, right? Because this germ cell, what's the ploidy of a germ cell? It is 2N. And of course, you should have all 46 chromosomes in there, but it would be really hard to follow what's going on. So for example, we just put another chromosome in there, and let's just call this the number 2. And that's how we label chromosomes, basically by their size and their length, right? We can look at the chromosomes underneath a microscope. So what phase is this right here? We see the nuclear envelope, but the chromatin is condensed. That is a typical prophase. Now, for meiosis, we have meiosis 1, and then we have meiosis 2. Let's just look and see what the difference is between these two. Okay, so these, since these are both number 1 chromosomes, right here and here, they have a special name. They're called homologous chromosomes. I wish I could write on the screen, homologous chromosomes. Homologous chromosomes because they code for about the same kinds of proteins in your body. Homologous chromosomes. So number 1 chromosome is homologous. So number 1 maternal chromosome is homologous to what chromosome over here in the paternal set? Number 1. Because they're going to code for information and might call for maybe different color hair or something, but it's still going to code for hair, for instance. All right. What's the homologous chromosome for maternal number 2? It's going to be paternal number 2. So those are the homologous chromosomes. They're going to have this similar size and shape. All right, so the chromatin is condensed. In metaphase 1, we see that the homologous chromosomes all line up right at the equator of the cell. And in anaphase, what typically happens during anaphase? That's when chromosomes start to separate from each other. But in meiosis, what is separating? It's not the sister chromatids. What's separating are the homologous chromosomes, right? So it's not these things that are separating, it is these things that are separating into two different cells. So that's what I want you to know about meiosis one. The key term is what's separating? Homologous chromosomes, right? So you still see at the end of meiosis one, you see these two daughter cells, but they still have replicated chromosomes. You see sister chromatids, right? You see this little X right here? What is that X? It's a chromosome and its replicated sister chromatids still attached to each other. And so the job of meiosis two, again, the same phases in mitosis. You have prophase, metaphase, anaphase. And you can see the chromosomes lining up in the equator of the cell for metaphase. And then during anaphase, the sister chromatids separate from each other. And now you end up with these four daughter cells, and these are not identical to each other. So they don't produce identical cells compared to the parent cell up over here. So is this for us? Is this us? Yeah, okay. Oh, thanks for reminding me. Yeah. Sign-in sheet. So, the questions that I would like for you to be able to answer would be, what separates during meiosis one? Aha, you have a question? My question first. Bio 241, the 29th, that's today. Yeah, sign it and pass it around, please. Okay, yeah. Okay. So before anything starts, right, we have a cell. So here's a cell, and here's the nucleus inside that cell. We're going to have how many chromosomes? 46. So here's one, here's another one, here's another one, and as they get higher in number, they actually get smaller and smaller and smaller. They all have a little bit different shape. But what do you have? You have one set of these all the way down to what, 23? But you also have another set over here, right, that are pretty much identical, right? Smaller and smaller and smaller, down to 23. This set you get from your mom, these you get from your dad, so you have a maternal and paternal set. But before we start to divide the cell up, what has to happen to these chromosomes? They've got to be replicated. And when they get replicated, what do they look like? They look like that, those little X's, right? And in mitosis, the only thing that happens is, and these things right here are called sister chromatids now. So here you just have a chromosome, here you have a replicated chromosome, and you got sister chromatids. How are they attached? What's this point right here called? That's the centromere. So during mitosis, the two daughter cells get a copy of each one of these chromosomes, but only one sister chromatid, not both copies of the replicated chromosome, just one. All right, but don't forget, during meiosis, we need, the result is a gamete over here with only one set of these, down to how many? 23. It only gets one number one, one number two, one number three. So during meiosis, all right, these two sets separate from each other in a random fashion, as well as the sister chromatid. So there are two rounds of separation. Okay? And the first, what's the first round? What separates? Yeah, because number one and number one are what we call homologous. These get separated into two different cells. And then the second round of meiosis, the sister chromatids separate. You might have to ask. Okay, go ahead. Well, you know what? During the first round, it's completely random what chromosomes end up in which cell. Okay? And that kind of explains why you're different than your parents and all your brothers and sisters. Because it's not always separated, okay, strictly by maternal and paternal. It's always just flipping a coin. When the number one homologous chromosome separates from each other, sometimes one cell gets the maternal, sometimes you get the paternal. All right, just by a flip of the coin, what traits you inherit. All right, so that is meiosis. Yeah. Okay, I didn't quite hear the beginning part of your question.
Prophase one.
Prophase, let me see. Prophase one, right here. I've never had to use terminology to describe the genetic nature of that cell right there. Is that a true 4N cell? You know, I would guess under certain circumstances, you certainly could use that terminology to describe it. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so that's it for this particular chapter. So we're almost done on time. Yeah, question.
What phase of mitosis does her meiosis genetic deformation like
stop? Okay. This is pretty interesting. Let's just think about this for a second. Have you ever heard of a circumstance where two people had a child? Okay. Well, this is more common. Two people get pregnant, okay, and two babies are born. What do you call that? That's twins. And if it's from the same zygote, right, they could be identical, right? So if the zygote splits into two individuals, then those two individuals or twins will be identical to each other because they have the same genes, or mostly identical. All right, so that's fairly common. But have you ever heard of two people having a baby and then 20 years later having a baby and those be identical, the two babies being identical to each other? Twins separated by 20 or 30 years. Okay. All right. Well, that has never happened. I'm sure that has never, maybe it has happened. You know what? It's possible for that to happen. But because of meiosis right here, things get rearranged so much that the odds of that happening are just astronomical. Right? You'd have to have billions and billions of babies via this process of meiosis to come up with the same individual again. Right? And that's kind of obvious because when you look around the room, do you ever see another you? Right? I mean, even if you go like to a football game at the Coliseum or something with 100,000 people and look around, can you ever find another you there? There's no way, right? Because of this process of meiosis. And one of the things that even mixes up the genes even more is what we call recombination. Right? So let me see, where's our last? Right here, recombination. At this stage right here, you see that the two homologous chromosomes line up with each other. They have the same shape and the same arrangement. And what can happen is, what can happen is that one end of a chromosome over here, or some part, some middle part, can hop over to this chromosome over here. So now you have a chromosome that is what? Part paternal information and part maternal information, even on that one chromosome. And that just mixes up the genes even further. And so we call that crossover. Okay.
And that happens in metaphase 1?
And that happens in, yeah, metaphase 1 right here.
Does that happen in 2?
Probably does, but I'm not sure. I mean, there's so much mixing of the genes that it wouldn't surprise me. But I'm not sure I know. Mitosis, does that happen? Oh, it does not happen during mitosis, as far as I know.
I think the book says it happens in prophase, the crossing over, which I thought was weird.
Well, you know, as soon as these chromosomes line up together, they can start happening. So I suppose. Yeah. Okay, so that introduces even more variability. So is it a good thing that there is diversity in the human population? Yeah. And the reason why is, look at all this biology that's necessary to produce that diversity. All right, and that's just very important because there are very few disease processes that affect the whole human population. I only really know of one process in women and one process in men. Does anybody know a pathological process that will affect every man, even though every man is different from another? It will affect, yes, prostatic hypertrophy. Okay, if a man is lucky enough to live long enough, maybe we'll talk about that one later on in the class. What about for women? What's a disease process that will affect every woman in here if you're lucky enough to live long enough? And that is osteoporosis. Okay, so there are very few disease processes because we're a diverse population that everybody can experience. All right, so I think that's it for today. So we'll start 4 next time. We're going to start 4, and what is next week? Next week is disaster drill week. So hopefully we won't have a disaster drill during class. All right, so sign that sign-in sheet, too, when it's going around. Oh, that's right. We are going to hop to 6. Sorry about that. We're hopping to 6. So how's it going?
Pretty good. I think you're the most detailed biology professor here by far.
Oh, wow. Oh, I get carried away sometimes.
Okay. You make sure you got your bases covered in regards to chemistry and smiles. Even anatomy reading, you want to be detailed.
Yeah. I get lost if it doesn't make a continuous story from the beginning.
Because, I mean, Stephanie Spuna had a different style. She's more like, you're responsible for your knowledge. You know, I'm assuming you know your chemistry and your anatomy. So we can skip through this.
Oh, yeah.
Go through it.
Yeah.
And we can go directly to talking about active transport.
Okay.
Secondary active.
Yeah, that's what we're going to get into next. Yeah.
She probably jumped directly into that, like, the second week. Dr. Sanchez, he covered this in anatomy as well, but you hit it on the head.
Okay. Good. It's fun biology. And if you just take physiology and anatomy, you don't learn biology unless somebody takes time to go over it. Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Putting squares here or anything like that.
No. Yeah.
All right. See you later.
Okay. Have a nice weekend.
Hi.
What
separates your meiosis one? That would be the germ cell, right?
What separates during
meiosis one?
Meiosis one are the homologous chromosomes.
Not the germ cell then.
Not the germ cell. The germ cell is the Yeah, the germ cell is the parent cell for meiosis.
Okay.
So, yeah, after meiosis one, the germ cell is really no longer there.
Okay. So the homologous
ones? Homologous chromosomes separate.
Got it.
During meiosis one. And then sister chromatids for meiosis two. Okay. Yeah. Hi.
Hello.
I'm changing something. I'm going to change. I think it's for the better. Because this is a fairly intense class because you get a test or a quiz every week. So when there's that disaster drill week, we thank you so much. We don't get a break, you know, because you take 14 quizzes. That's good because then you can drop a lot of quizzes. So that was a pain for me to figure out where to put that test. I didn't want you guys to get too far behind. So we're scheduled to have a test on Tuesday. Bottom line, they have now narrowed down the disaster drill to either Monday or Tuesday, but not Wednesday or Thursday, or certainly not on Thursday. So I'm going to move the test from Tuesday to Thursday. Ah, so I think we can scoot around the disaster drill, but you know, as soon as we do that, guess what they're going to do? Well, we're going to give the disaster drill now on Thursday or something. I'm not sure, but or next or the week after. I don't know. But anyway, so that's what...
We're going to have a long test until Thursday.
Yes, the big lecture test is on Thursday. Make sure I mention... I'm recording this on my other class.